Welcome, curious minds, to the deep dive. Today we're plunging into one of America's most pivotal and, well, profoundly paradoxical figures, Thomas Jefferson. You know him as the author of the Declaration of Independence, our third president. But what if I told you he was also a self-taught architect who designed his iconic home, Monticello, an inventor credited with the swivel chair that helped him draft foundational documents, and even a pioneer in American paleontology, meticulously describing an extinct giant ground sloth.
Right. For Jefferson, life wasn't just about politics. It seems it was an insatiable, lifelong pursuit of knowledge across, well, practically every field imaginable.
Exactly.
And that, I think, is where the captivating complexity of Jefferson truly unfolds. He wasn't merely a political leader. He was a polymath, a true Renaissance man whose influence touched philosophy, science, architecture, and the very blueprint of the early republic.
Yeah, a central force.
A central force in shaping not just our government, but the intellectual and cultural landscape of the nascent United States, making him a figure whose contradictions are, you know, almost as defining as his achievements.
That's why our mission today on this deep dive is to go beyond the textbook. We're sifting through a rich mosaic of sources, everything from his personal letters and architectural plans to presidential papers, scholarly analyses, and even modern genetic studies. Mm. We're aiming to give you a nuanced understanding of Jefferson's multifaceted life, his monumental achievements, and yes, the deeply challenging contradictions that continue to shape our understanding of American ideals. We want to leave you not just informed, but truly well-informed with those aha moments that only come from connecting the dots.
And our exploration will draw from his own autobiography, his seminal Notes on the State of Virginia, countless letters exchanged with fellow founders, and critical historical and genetic studies. These diverse sources allow us to examine Jefferson from multiple angles, uncovering surprising insights and wrestling with the paradoxes that make him such an enduring and sometimes, well, unsettling figure in American history.
The formative years, from Virginia planter to Enlightenment scholar.
Okay, so to truly understand the architect of a nation, we really have to trace the foundations of his own being, right? Let's delve into Jefferson's formative years in colonial Virginia.
Sounds good.
Born on April 13, 1743, at Shadwell Plantation, he was the third of 10 children in Virginia's planter class, a social and economic tier inherently dependent on slave labor. His father, Peter Jefferson, was a self-taught planter and surveyor, and his mother was Jane Randolph from, you know, a pretty prominent Virginia family.
And this was an environment of both, well, burgeoning opportunity and profound moral compromise. You have the raw American wilderness ripe for expansion, yet deeply intertwined with the entrenched institution of slavery.
Right.
Peter Jefferson, despite his own lack of formal education, seems to have really instilled in young Thomas an intense desire for learning. The family's brief move to Tuckahoe Plantation in 1745 and their eventual return to Shadwell before 1753 exposed him early to both frontier practicality and the immense responsibilities of plantation management. These early experiences undoubtedly left an indelible mark shaping his developing worldview.
And his education really built upon that foundation. He began formal English schooling at 5, then at 9, he attended a local school where he dove into the natural world, Latin, Greek, and French. He was an avid reader of his father's, well, relatively modest library. Mm. From 1758 to 1760, under Reverend James Morey, he continued his intensive studies in history, science, and the classics.
This foundational education, particularly in classical languages and the natural world, clearly cultivated a lifelong curiosity. The study of Latin and Greek wasn't just academic. It was an immersion in the philosophical traditions of antiquity, particularly the ideas of the Enlightenment, which emphasized reason, individual rights, and the potential for human progress and self-governance.
Right. The very ideas he'd later champion.
Exactly. These very traditions would later underpin his revolutionary thought and his articulation of natural rights. His father's emphasis on knowledge, despite his own limitations, deeply instilled in Jefferson an appreciation for education that he would later champion for the entire American Republic.
It's fascinating, too, how these early influences extended beyond the classroom. He became acquainted with various American Indian leaders, including Cherokee Chief Ostenaco, who apparently often visited Shadwell en route to Williamsburg.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and he also met and admired Patrick Henry, who would later become one of the most, well, fiery orators of the Revolution. These personal connections and intellectual exposures were clearly shaping the future statesman, embedding him in the diverse realities of colonial Virginia.
His intellectual development then accelerated significantly when, at age 18 in 1761, he entered the College of William and Mary.
Okay.
Here, he studied mathematics and philosophy with William Small, a Scottish professor who became a profound mentor. Small introduced Jefferson to British empiricists like John Locke, Francis Bacon, and Isaac Newton, thinkers who would directly influence Jefferson's later articulation of natural rights and democratic principles.
Those are the big three he always mentioned.
The very ones. Small also brought Jefferson into an exclusive inner circle with George Wythe, a prominent law professor, and Francis Fakeu, the royal governor. Their Friday dinner parties were, as Jefferson later wrote, where he heard more common good sense, more rational and philosophical conversations than in all the rest of my life. This period was a true intellectual crucible, honing his critical thinking and rhetorical skills.
That feeling of finding your intellectual tribe, where conversations genuinely spark those aha moments, is something I think many of us can relate to. Jefferson's experience really shows how critical mentorship and stimulating discourse can be, not just in shaping an individual, but, you know, in his case, maybe even altering the course of history.
Absolutely.
That intense intellectual environment also fostered remarkable discipline. After admittedly squandering away his first year on parties, Jefferson committed himself, famously studying 15 hours a day during his second year.
15 hours? That's dedication.
Right. He concluded his formal studies in April 1762 and then read law under George Wythe, grounding him in the legal traditions that would inform his later governmental reforms. He was incredibly well-read, systematically compiling insights into commonplace books, a habit he maintained throughout his life.
And speaking of knowledge, his lifelong obsession with books is, well, it's legendary. After his first library of about 200 volumes was destroyed in a fire in 1770, he immediately began building another.
Started right over.
Exactly. This second library, nearly 6,500 volumes, became so extensive that he eventually sold it to the Library of Congress for, I think it was around $23,950 in 1814. This was to help rebuild the national collection after British forces burned it during the War of 1812.
A huge contribution.
And what did he do then? He immediately started a third library. He famously wrote to John Adams, "I cannot live without books." This wasn't just a hobby, it was the core intellectual engine powering his extraordinary contributions, reflecting a mind constantly synthesizing information from diverse fields.
Revolutionary fire shaping a new nation's ideals.
Okay, so with that formidable intellectual foundation, Jefferson was about to step onto a public stage, one that was, you know, ablaze with revolutionary fervor. But as he began to shape a new nation's ideals, the profound contradictions of his own life would soon emerge, setting the tone for a lifelong struggle between principle and reality.
Yeah, that tension starts early.
He was granted admission to the Virginia Bar in 1767, then represented Albemarle County in Virginia's House of Burgesses from 1769 to 1775.
And this marked his official entry into public service, immediately grappling with colonial rights and, of course, the deeply entrenched institution of slavery. His rigorous legal training prepared him directly for legislative work, but it was in these early actions that we see the seeds of his later struggles.
This is where we first confront one of Jefferson's most profound contradictions, right? While in the House of Burgesses, he pursued reforms to slavery. In 1769, he sponsored legislation to give masters discretion to emancipate slaves, though it faced, well, strong opposition in agrarian Virginia.
Understandably, given the economy.
Exactly. Even more strikingly, as a lawyer, he represented seven freedom-seeking enslaved people, waiving his fee for one, arguing they should be freed under natural law, stating, "Everyone comes into the world with the right to his own person."
Wow, that's a powerful statement for the time.
It really is. Although the judge ruled against him, Jefferson apparently provided money to aid the client's escape. So on one hand, he's actively trying to reform the system and arguing for natural rights, yet he's deeply embedded in that very system. It's a powerful illustration of the intellectual argument that would later find its way into the Declaration of Independence.
This tension between his espoused ideals and his lived reality is absolutely central to understanding Jefferson. And at the same time, he embarked on another lifelong project in 1768, the construction of Monticello Little Mountain, his primary residence near Charlottesville.
Ah, Monticello.
He spent most of his adult life designing it, calling architecture my delight, and putting up and pulling down one of my favorite amusements. This neoclassical masterpiece, in the Palladian style, was constructed mostly by local masons and carpenters, assisted by his enslaved people.
Which again brings us back to that paradox. Monticello stands as a physical paradox. a monument to Enlightenment ideals of beauty and innovation, built brick by brick by the very people denied those ideals. It's a stark and permanent reminder of the, well, the nation's foundational hypocrisy, in a way.
It really is.
Amidst these public and architectural endeavors, Jefferson's personal life also saw significant change. On January 1, 1772, he married Martha Wales Skelton, a 23-year-old widow. Their bond seems to have been deep. Historian Dumas Malone described it as the happiest period of Jefferson's life, painting a picture of domestic harmony as Martha, a skilled pianist, played while Jefferson accompanied her on violin or cello.
But their joy was tempered by immense sorrow. They had 6 children, but only 2, Martha Patsy and Mary Polly, survived to adulthood. Then in 1773, Martha's father died, leaving them 135 enslaved people, 11,000 acres, and significant debts that would plague Jefferson for years.
So more enslaved people and debt.
Yes, exactly. And Martha herself suffered from ill health and frequent childbirth, ultimately dying on September 6, 1782, shortly after her last child's birth. She reportedly made Jefferson promise never to remarry. He was, by all accounts, grief-stricken, pacing relentlessly for weeks, with his daughter Martha describing many a violent burst of grief. This profound personal loss, combined with the inherited burden of debt, surely shaped his perspective as he navigated the tumultuous waters of revolutionary politics.
This personal backdrop leads us directly to what is arguably his most monumental public achievement, the Declaration of Independence. At the relatively young age of 33, Jefferson was the primary author, one of the youngest delegates to the Second Continental Congress.
Yeah, remarkably young.
He was deeply inspired by Enlightenment ideals of individual sanctity and the writings of John Locke and Montesquieu. John Adams, recognizing Jefferson's writing skill and maybe the political expediency of a Virginian taking the lead, famously persuaded the Committee of Five to choose him.
Jefferson largely wrote it in isolation between June 11 and 28, 1776, drawing on his earlier draft for the Virginia Constitution and George Mason's Virginia Declaration of Rights. Congress debated it and famously removed about a fourth of his draft, including a section criticizing King George III for supposedly forcing slavery onto the colonies, a deletion Jefferson resented but didn't publicly oppose.
That's a crucial detail, the slavery clause being removed.
Absolutely. It was unanimously ratified on July 4, 1776, and delegates signed it on August 2nd, knowing full well they were committing high treason against the crown. This document is truly the philosophical bedrock of the nation. Jefferson's genius was in synthesizing existing Enlightenment thought into a concise, powerful statement of universal human rights. And that internal struggle over the slavery clause, it reveals the inherent tension within the founding generation, a tension that would continue to define American history for generations.
This wasn't just a call for independence. It was a philosophical manifesto that really laid the groundwork for modern human rights movements globally, a blueprint for self-determination that still resonates today. Just 2 days after ratification, the Pennsylvania Evening Post was the first to publish it. On July 8, it was read publicly and simultaneously in Trenton, Easton, and Philadelphia, immediately broadcasting this audacious claim.
It spread the word quickly.
Yeah. Historian Joseph Ellis called its words the most potent and consequential in American history. What an extraordinary risk for such a legacy.
State leadership and national service.
Right. So following the monumental declaration, Jefferson immediately turned his attention to implementing revolutionary principles at the state level. Though a colonel in the Albemarle County Militia, his real work for the new republic lay in legislative reform.
Makes sense.
Elected to the Virginia House of Delegates in September 1776, he focused on establishing the state constitution. For nearly 3 years, Jefferson assisted with this, but was particularly proud of his bill for establishing religious freedom. This landmark legislation prohibited state support of religious institutions or enforcement of religious doctrine, a truly radical concept for the time that later became a cornerstone of American liberty.
That's a crucial point. His dedication to religious freedom was, well, groundbreaking. He also undertook the monumental task of revising 126 state laws, streamlining the judicial system, and proposing general education statutes, which he considered the very basis of Republican government.
Foundational work.
Absolutely. Furthermore, he led efforts to abolish feudal and unnatural distinctions, like entail, which kept land within specific family lines in primogeniture, where the eldest son inherited everything. He was aiming to create a more egalitarian society by preventing a hereditary aristocracy. It's easy to forget that the revolution wasn't just fought on battlefields, but in legislative chambers, defining what it meant to build a new society from the ground up.
His dedication to these principles was certainly tested when he was elected governor of Virginia for one-year terms in 1779 and 1780.
Right, his governorship.
He transferred the state capital from Williamsburg to Richmond and continued to introduce measures for public education, religious freedom, and inheritance reform. His governorship, however, placed him in direct danger during the Revolutionary War. In 1781, during General Benedict Arnold's invasion of Virginia, Jefferson narrowly escaped Richmond just ahead of British forces.
Wow, close call.
Very. Later, General Cornwallis dispatched Bannister Tarleton to capture Jefferson in the assembly at Monticello. Jack Jouett of the Virginia militia heroically thwarted the plan, allowing Jefferson to escape to Poplar Forest.
Imagine the stakes almost captured by Tarleton at Monticello. Despite his legislative achievements, these wartime challenges and accusations of failing to adequately protect the state led to him not being reelected.
Yeah.
It really shows the unforgiving nature of public office in the early republic.
Definitely.
Following his governorship, Jefferson authored a crucial work published in 1785, Notes on the State of Virginia. This book, a response to a French diplomat's inquiry, explored what constitutes a good society, using Virginia as an exemplar, including extensive data on natural resources and the economy.
Notes on the State of Virginia offers a profound, if frankly troubling, window into Jefferson's mind. While praised for its breadth of information and advocacy for a good society, its sections on race controversially articulated his belief that black and white people could not live together as free people in one society due to justified resentments of the enslaved.
Yeah, that's incredibly problematic.
It really is. This wasn't just a window. It was almost a chilling blueprint for a segregated future, penned by the same man who articulated universal liberty. It reveals the profound cognitive dissonance at the very heart of the American project. Conversely, his views on American Indians, equating them to Europeans, challenged some prevailing notions of the time.
He then continued his national service as a Virginia delegate to the Congress of the Confederation after the peace treaty with Great Britain in 1783. Building a new nation from scratch involved so many practicalities.
True.
He recommended an American currency based on the decimal system, a system we still use today, which was adopted. He also advised the formation of the Committee of the States to fill the power vacuum when Congress was in recess. This highlights his meticulous, systemic approach to nation building, thinking about everything from currency to interim governance.
And this systemic approach extended to shaping Western expansion policy. He was the principal author of the Land Ordinance of 1784, which saw Virginia cede its claims northwest of the Ohio River. He insisted this territory should not be colonial, but divided into sections that could become states.
Planning for growth.
Exactly. Crucially, he also wrote an ordinance banning slavery in all the nation's territories. However, Congress rejected the ban. Despite this, the provisions banning slavery, known as the Jefferson Proviso, were modified and implemented 3 years later in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, representing a partial but significant victory for his anti-slavery efforts in shaping the future of the nation.
Diplomat, vice president, and party architect.
Okay, so as the young republic found its footing, Jefferson's journey led him across the Atlantic into the world of diplomacy. In 1784, Congress appointed him Minister Plenipotentiary for negotiating treaties of amity and commerce, and he joined Benjamin Franklin and John Adams in Paris.
Quite the diplomatic dame.
Indeed. Less than a year later, he succeeded Franklin as Minister to France.
Jefferson's time in France from 1785 to 1789 was crucial for his understanding of international relations and European political dynamics. When the French foreign minister commented, "You replace Monsieur Franklin, I hear," Jefferson's witty reply was, "I succeed. No man can replace him."
Huh. Nice. Shows respect, but also confidence.
Exactly. It shows deep respect for Franklin, but also a clear assertion of his own identity. This direct exposure to European capitals broadened his perspective and directly influenced his later foreign policy decisions as president. Personally, his young daughter Patsy was educated at Pentamon Abbey while there. He also met and fell in love with Maria Causeway, a married Italian-English musician, maintaining a lifelong correspondence.
However, his personal life became entangled with a much deeper, more troubling aspect of his legacy during this period. In June 1787, his youngest surviving child, Polly, arrived in Paris, accompanied by a young enslaved woman from Monticello, Sally Hemings.
Ah, yes, this is critical.
Her older brother, James Hemings, was already there. According to Sally's son, Madison Hemings, the 16-year-old Sally and Jefferson began a sexual relationship in Paris, where she became pregnant. Madison indicated Hemings agreed to return to the U.S. only after Jefferson promised to free her children when they came of age. This is a critical and sensitive detail, illustrating the complex human relationships and profound power dynamics inherent to slavery.
Absolutely. While wrestling with these personal complexities, he also witnessed history unfold on a grand scale. He became a regular companion of the Marquis de Lafayette and was actually in Paris during the storming of the Bastille on July 14, 1789.
Wow, imagine seeing that firsthand.
Right. He consulted with Lafayette as he drafted the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen. Witnessing the ideals and eventual excesses of the French Revolution profoundly shaped his evolving ideas about democracy and the stability of a republic.
Upon his return to America in September 1789, Jefferson quickly accepted President Washington's invitation to serve as the nation's first Secretary of State.
Stepping right back into the fray.
Immediately. This thrust him into the thick of early cabinet conflicts over pressing issues like the national debt and the location of the new national capital, putting him directly at odds with Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton. The Compromise of 1790 eventually settled the capital on the Potomac, and the federal government assumed state war debts.
And this fundamental clash between Jefferson and Hamilton, an agrarian vision versus an industrial one, states' rights versus a strong federal government, distrust of banks versus national credit, truly laid the groundwork for the two-party system we recognize today.
It really did.
Jefferson opposed a national debt, and Hamilton's vision of a consolidated federal government, national credit, and a national bank, believing it ignored individuals and farmers and violated the 10th Amendment. He attempted to undermine Hamilton's agenda, nearly leading Washington to dismiss him. He later left voluntarily in December 1793. This wasn't just a political disagreement. It was a deeply philosophical divide about the very nature of the American Republic.
That philosophical divide led directly to the formation of the first party system. Along with James Madison and Philip Freneau, Jefferson co-founded the National Gazette in Philadelphia in 1791 to counter Federalist policies, even encouraging anonymous critical essays.
Using the press strategically.
Definitely. In May 1792, he implored Washington to run for re-election, but also used the opportunity to articulate Democratic-Republican principles, states' rights and local control, opposing federal power concentration. This marked a pivotal moment in American politics.
His foreign policy during this period was equally contentious. He supported France against Britain in 1793, even during the brutal Reign of Terror, stating, "To back away from France would be to undermine the cause of republicanism in America."
A strong stance.
Very. After resigning from the cabinet, he continued his political opposition. In the 1796 election, he lost to John Adams but became vice president under the electoral laws of the time. As presiding officer of the Senate, he took a largely passive role, even publishing a manual of parliamentary practice in 1800. However, in confidential talks in 1797, he attacked Adams, encouraged France to invade England, and advised stalling American envoys, actions that contributed to the XYZ affair and the quasi-war.
Wow, that sounds almost like undermining the government he was part of.
It was certainly controversial and highlights the intense political maneuvering of the era. Then came the infamous Alien and Sedition Acts. Jefferson believed these Federalist laws were unconstitutional and designed to suppress Democratic Republicans.
Right.
He anonymously co-authored the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions with James Madison, asserting states' rights to nullify federal laws deemed unconstitutional. He even warned they would drive these states into revolution and blood.
Strong words.
Indeed. This raised serious concerns about disunion, and Washington was apparently appalled by the resolutions. This era truly shows the high-stakes political environment of the young republic, where personal animosities and ideological clashes could escalate into national crises.
President of the United States defining a new republic.
Okay, the stage was now set for arguably the most pivotal and tumultuous election in early American history, the election of 1800. Jefferson ran for president against John Adams once again.
Round two.
Adams's campaign was severely weakened by unpopular taxes and quite a bit of Federalist infighting.
The Democratic Republicans, led by Jefferson, accused Federalists of being secret pro-Britain monarchists. Federalists, in turn, charged Jefferson was a godless libertine beholden to the French. UCLA history professor Joyce Appleby called it one of the most acrimonious in the annals of American history.
Sounds nasty.
It really was. The Democratic Republicans ultimately won more electoral college votes, due in part to the three-fifths compromise inflating the South's count. But here's the crucial twist. Jefferson and his vice presidential candidate, Aaron Burr, unexpectedly tied.
Tied. So what happened?
Because of this tie, the election was decided by the Federalist-dominated U.S. House of Representatives. And in a surprising turn, Alexander Hamilton, Jefferson's bitter rival, lobbied Federalist representatives on Jefferson's behalf, believing him the lesser political evil compared to Burr.
Hamilton supported Jefferson.
Wow.
Strange bedfellows indeed. After 36 ballots, Jefferson finally became president.
36 ballots. Incredible.
This peaceful transfer of power from one party to another after such intense partisan conflict and an electoral deadlock was a watershed moment in modern history. It demonstrated the remarkable resilience of the American constitutional system, despite the deep ideological divisions that threatened to tear the young republic apart. It set a precedent that democracy, even contentious democracy, could actually work.
Jefferson was sworn in by Chief Justice John Marshall on March 4, 1801, at the new Capitol. Conspicuously, outgoing President Adams did not attend.
Ouch. Bit of a snub.
Seems like it. Jefferson, disliking formal etiquette, made a deliberate statement by walking to the Capitol from his boarding house, plainly dressed. His inaugural address struck a profound note of reconciliation. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists.
Trying to heal divisions.
Exactly. He stressed equal and exact justice to all men, minority rights, freedom of speech, religion, and press, declaring that a free Republican government was the strongest government on earth. It was a deliberate rejection of monarchical pomp, signaling a new era of Republican simplicity.
Jefferson's first major challenge was shrinking the nation's considerable $83 million national debt. With Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin's expert help, he systematically began dismantling Hamilton's Federalist fiscal system.
Getting right to it.
This included eliminating unpopular taxes, closing unnecessary offices, and cutting useless establishments and expenses. While he initially wanted to dismantle the First Bank of the United States, he was eventually dissuaded by Gallatin, who argued for its utility. Jefferson instead focused on shrinking the Navy, preferring a fleet of inexpensive gunboats for local defense. By the end of his two terms, he had successfully reduced the national debt from $83 million to $57 million.
It's a significant reduction.
It was. This was a direct reversal of Federalist economic policies, reflecting Jefferson's core belief in limited government and agrarian self-sufficiency.
His domestic actions went further. He pardoned several individuals imprisoned under the controversial Alien and Sedition Acts, a direct repudiation of his Federalist predecessors.
Undoing some of Adams's work.
Right. Congress, under his leadership, repealed the Judiciary Act of 1801, removing many of Adams's midnight judges, which led to the landmark Marbury v. Madison Supreme Court case, famously asserting the principle of judicial review. He also appointed three Supreme Court justices.
Shaping the judiciary.
And recognizing the critical need for a national military university, he founded the United States Military Academy at West Point in 1802 to produce an officer engineering corps grounded in science. And in a nod to his own love of books, he took great interest in the Library of Congress, recommending acquisitions and granting access to the president and vice president.
In foreign affairs, Jefferson faced an immediate challenge with the Barbary pirates. American merchant ships, no longer protected by the Royal Navy, were being preyed upon, their cargoes pillaged, and crews enslaved.
A serious problem for a new nation.
Definitely. Jefferson, who had long opposed paying tribute, authorized a U.S. Navy fleet in 1801 and secured a declaration of war from Congress, making the First Barbary War the first foreign war for the U.S. After diplomatic and military actions, a treaty restored peace. This was a bold move for a young nation, asserting its sovereignty on the global stage and challenging a long-standing practice of paying tribute, a powerful statement of American resolve.
But the most significant foreign policy achievement of his presidency, and indeed one of the most formative events in American history, was the Louisiana Purchase in 1803.
Ah, the big one.
Spain had secretly ceded Louisiana to France in 1800. Jefferson was deeply concerned by Napoleon's intentions, fearing it would threaten American security and vital Mississippi River shipping. He instructed James Monroe and Robert R. Livingston to negotiate the purchase of New Orleans. Unexpectedly, Napoleon, in dire need of funds, offered to sell the entire 827,987 square miles for $15 million.
An incredible opportunity.
U.S. negotiators accepted on April 30, 1803. The news reached Jefferson in July, doubling the size of the U.S. overnight.
Just like that. Monumental. This was a monumental, almost accidental achievement. It secured the most fertile land on earth, making the U.S. self-sufficient, curtail European presence, and open the way for westward expansion. Jefferson initially believed a constitutional amendment was needed, but fearing opposition and delay, he urged speedy ratification. The Senate swiftly ratified it 24-7. Historians consider it a major accomplishment, with Frederick Jackson Turner calling it the most formative event in American history.
Anticipating further westward settlement, Jefferson immediately arranged for the exploration of this uncharted territory. He personally tutored Meriwether Lewis in various sciences and provided full access to his library for the Lewis and Clark Expedition, 1803 to 1806.
Preparing them thoroughly.
The expedition yielded vast scientific, geographic, and ethnographic knowledge, including invaluable information on many Indian tribes. However, this is another area where Jefferson's ideals collided with pragmatic and often, well, harsh realities. He formally adopted an assimilation policy toward American Indians, his civilization program, believing them equal in body and mind to Europeans, though culturally and technologically inferior.
What's truly complex here, though, is the stark contradiction. While he advocated for assimilation, his administration also pursued policies that, according to some historians, were basically pretexts to seize lands. His chilling statement to Secretary of War Henry Dearborn, "If we are constrained to lift the hatchet against any tribe, we will never lay it down until that tribe is exterminated or driven beyond the Mississippi," reveals a harsh, almost genocidal undercurrent to his policies when faced with resistance.
Yeah, that's incredibly disturbing.
It is. It's a profound complexity in his legacy that cannot be ignored.
Despite these emerging contradictions, Jefferson was overwhelmingly reelected in 1804 with George Clinton as his vice president, citing a strong economy, lower taxes, and the hugely popular Louisiana Purchase. However, his second term was fraught with challenges.
The second term curse, perhaps.
A split in the Democratic-Republican Party emerged, with John Randolph accusing him of moving too far in a Federalist direction. More critically, relations with Britain deteriorated rapidly due to impressment of American sailors and aggressive trade policies, inflamed by Napoleon's growing aggression in Europe after his victory at Austerlitz, making American neutrality almost impossible.
Squeezed between Britain and France.
Exactly. In response, Jefferson enacted the highly controversial Embargo Act of 1807 against both France and Britain. This act, intended to avoid war by using economic coercion, triggered widespread economic chaos in the U.S. and was met with strong criticism and evasion.
A huge backlash.
Huge. Instead of retreating, Jefferson responded by sending federal agents to track smugglers and enforcing the act with new legislation, a move some historians argue surpassed the Alien and Sedition Acts in terms of executive power. He announced he would not seek a third term and increasingly focused on Monticello. He signed the repeal of the embargo shortly before leaving office in 1809, famously stating he felt like a prisoner released from his chains.
Wow, that says a lot.
It really does. It's fascinating how a president, so committed to limited government, found himself using such expansive executive power in a desperate attempt to avoid war. His sentiment upon leaving office speaks volumes about the immense toll the presidency took on him during this challenging period.
Controversies and complexity.
Even after his presidency, Jefferson's life remained a whirlwind of activity, influence, and, yes, continued controversy. One of the most dramatic episodes was the Burr conspiracy and trial.
Aaron Burr again.
Right. Jefferson's relationship with his former vice president rapidly eroded after that tumultuous 1801 electoral deadlock, with Jefferson suspecting Burr sought the presidency for himself. Burr was dropped from the 1804 ticket, and after losing the New York governorship, he famously dueled and mortally wounded Alexander Hamilton in 1804.
The infamous duel.
That's the one. This immediately plunged Burr into deep legal trouble. By 1804, he contacted British Minister Anthony Mary, offering to cede U.S. Western Territory for money and ships. After leaving office in 1805, Burr conspired with Louisiana Territory Governor James Wilkinson for a military expedition, possibly to seize Mexico or Spanish Florida, or even to form a secessionist state.
A conspiracy against the U.S.
That's what it looked like. The plot unraveled when Wilkinson exposed it to Jefferson, who promptly ordered Burr's arrest. Burr was captured in 1807 and tried for treason.
So a trial for treason.
And here's a crucial twist in the story. Jefferson attempted to influence the verdict, telling Congress Burr's guilt was beyond question. But the case came before his political foe, Chief Justice John Marshall.
Marshall again.
Marshall, asserting judicial independence, dismissed the treason charge. Jefferson refused to testify, making the first argument for executive privilege, though he did provide relevant documents. After a three-month trial, Burr was found not guilty, a verdict Jefferson publicly denounced.
So Burr walked free.
He did. This episode exposed the fragility of the young republic and the dangers of political ambition, highlighting the tension between executive power and judicial independence in the early days of the American legal system.
And speaking of trust, or rather, maybe misplaced trust, we have the case of James Wilkinson, the same guy who exposed Burr.
The very same. Commanding General James Wilkinson was appointed Louisiana Territory governor by Jefferson in 1805. Jefferson admired Wilkinson's work ethic and trusted him, despite warnings. However, in 1806, Jefferson received information that Wilkinson was on the Spanish payroll, but took no action due to insufficient evidence.
On the Spanish payroll while governor.
That was the allegation. Later investigations in the House and a military court exonerated Wilkinson, and Jefferson retained him. It was 20th century evidence from Spanish archives that conclusively proved Wilkinson was indeed on the Spanish payroll.
Wow. So Jefferson was warned, but didn't act.
It seems so. This reveals a significant blind spot for Jefferson, a stark reminder that even the most insightful leaders can be deceived, and that historical truths can sometimes be uncovered only long after the fact, reshaping our understanding.
Another politically fraught initiative during his second term was his attempted annexation of Florida.
Right. After Louisiana, he set his sights on Florida. Following the Louisiana Purchase, Jefferson attempted to acquire West Florida from Spain. In 1805, he secretly requested $2 million to purchase Florida, believing the money would go to Napoleon to pressure Spain. Yes, and congressional floor leader John Randolph opposed this secrecy, fearing where the money would truly end up. The bill passed after Jefferson controversially maneuvered to replace Randolph, but the venture ultimately failed, damaging Jefferson's reputation and sparking charges of undue executive influence over Congress.
So it backfired.
It did. Jefferson's desire for expansion, mirroring the success of the Louisiana Purchase, led him to employ methods that clashed with his own stated principles of transparency and limited executive power.
And these foreign policy challenges only escalated, eventually leading to his infamous Embargo Act, which we touched on.
Right. Let's circle back to that. Starting in 1806, the Royal Navy escalated its practice of stopping American merchantmen and impressing American sailors. Approximately 6,000 U.S. sailors were seized, causing widespread public anger.
6,000 sailors? That's huge.
It was a major grievance. Jefferson called for a boycott of British goods, and Congress passed non-importation acts, but they were never really enforced. The Monroe-Pinckney Treaty of 1806 failed to address impressment, leading Jefferson to refuse its ratification.
So diplomacy wasn't working.
Not on this issue. Then came the dramatic Chesapeake Leopard affair in 1807, when the British warship HMS Leopard fired on the USS Chesapeake after it refused to search for deserters, then forcibly removed four from the American vessel.
Firing on a U.S. Navy ship.
A major incident. Jefferson responded by banning British warships from U.S. waters, unilaterally calling for 100,000 militia, and ordering arms purchases, stating, "The laws of necessity, of self-preservation, of saving our country when in danger, are of higher obligation than strict observance of written laws." He called for Congress to enact an embargo or consider war.
So the Embargo Act was the alternative to war?
Essentially, yes. In December 1807, Congress, unwilling to declare war, passed the Embargo Act. However, as we discussed, this act triggered economic chaos in the U.S. with devastating declines in exports and was met with strong criticism and widespread evasion.
Leading him to use more executive power.
It's exactly. Jefferson deployed federal agents and passed additional enforcement acts. He signed the repeal of the embargo shortly before leaving office in March 1809. This period perfectly illustrates the challenges of maintaining neutrality and national sovereignty, showing a deep commitment to avoiding direct military conflict, even if it meant significant domestic sacrifice, and an expansion of executive power he likely felt uncomfortable with.
Post-presidency, legacy, and lasting influence.
Okay, so as we enter the final chapter of Jefferson's life, we find him retreating from the presidency, but certainly not from public life or his profound influence. After his presidency, he remained incredibly influential, corresponding extensively with his protégés, James Madison and James Monroe.
Still guiding from Monticello.
Seems like it. In fact, the Monroe Doctrine, enacted in 1823, strongly resembled advice he gave to Monroe, highlighting his continued role as an elder statesman.
This underscores Jefferson's role as an intellectual and political patriarch, continuing to shape American foreign policy and political thought long after leaving office. His intellectual contributions didn't cease with his presidency. Rather, they shifted to a more advisory and foundational role, influencing the next generation of leaders.
And speaking of foundations, one of his most significant post-presidency projects was the founding of the University of Virginia.
UVA, a true passion project.
Jefferson envisioned a university free of church influences, where students could specialize in new areas of study and one that was accessible based on ability. He proposed it in 1800, and after years of tireless effort, founded the University of Virginia in 1819.
Quite a gap between proposal and founding.
It took time. He was not only the principal designer of the buildings, but also planned the curriculum and served as its first rector upon its opening in 1825.
This was truly an architectural and educational masterpiece. Monticello was his personal passion, perhaps, but UVA was his lasting public architectural legacy. He drew heavily on Greek and Roman styles, believing them representative of American democracy and reason.
The academical village.
Exactly. The innovative academical village layout with its pavilions, colonnades, student rooms, and gardens reflected his educational ideas. Crucially, a library, not a church, was at its very center, emphasizing its secular nature, a highly controversial stance at the time, but a testament to his belief in the supremacy of reason and public learning.
That vision for a university designed entirely around secular learning, rooted in classical ideals, and with a library at its heart, it's a powerful testament to his belief in reason and public education as the cornerstones of a stable republic.
Absolutely.
But perhaps one of the most moving aspects of his later life was his reconciliation with John Adams.
Oh, this is a wonderful story.
They were close friends in their early careers, but became bitter political rivals during the Federalist-Republican split of the 1790s. Not communicating directly for over a decade after Jefferson succeeded Adams. Benjamin Rush eventually prodded them to reestablish contact.
Good old Benjamin Rush playing peacemaker.
Right. In 1812, Adams sent a New Year's greeting, and Jefferson warmly responded, initiating what historian David McCullough calls one of the most extraordinary correspondences in American history. Over the next 14 years, they exchanged 158 letters discussing their political differences, justifying their roles in the revolution, and debating its global import.
Imagine reading those letters.
I know. Imagine reading their letters filled with reflections on the very founding of the nation. These two giants, once fierce opponents, found a way to bridge their divides in old age, reminding us that profound disagreements can sometimes give way to reconciliation and mutual respect.
And their story ends with an almost unbelievable coincidence. Both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence.
The 50th anniversary. Incredible.
Adams's last words were, "Thomas Jefferson survives," unaware that Jefferson had died hours earlier. Then President John Quincy Adams called it visible and palpable remarks of divine favor, cementing their intertwined legacies in the public consciousness through this sheer improbability.
In his final years, Jefferson, then 77, began his autobiography in 1821, covering the period from 1743 to 1790. He focused on the Revolutionary era and his opposition to a privileged aristocracy, promoting instead an aristocracy of virtue and talent.
Still shaping his narrative.
He also sympathized deeply with the Greek War of Independence, exchanging ideas with Greek scholar Adamantios Karais and advising on a political system based on classical liberalism and the U.S. state model. A deeply emotional moment occurred in the summer of 1824 when the Marquis de Lafayette, whom Jefferson hadn't seen since 1789, visited Monticello.
A reunion decades in the making.
Jefferson's grandson recorded them bursting into tears as they fell into each other's arms.
Wow, powerful.
Jefferson's final days were weighed down by approximately $100,000 of debt, a sum that loomed large over his desire to leave an inheritance for his heirs. He even applied for a public lottery fundraiser in 1826.
Trying to solve his financial woes right up to the end.
His health deteriorated, and he died on July 4th, 1826, at 12:50 p.m. at age 83, on that incredibly symbolic 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. His final significant words were, "Is it the 4th?"
Focused on that date.
He was interred at Monticello under an epitaph he wrote himself. "Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia."
Notice what's missing.
Exactly. Notably, his political roles, including the presidency, were absent. He considered these three his greatest achievements. Sadly, his estate, possessions, and enslaved people were all sold at public auction to pay his debts. The fact that his epitaph focused on the Declaration, religious freedom, and the university rather than his presidency gives us profound insight into what he believes was his most enduring legacy.
Jefferson's enduring ideas and complexities.
Okay, so now that we've traversed his extraordinary life, let's maybe turn our attention to Jefferson's enduring ideas and the complexities that continue to challenge our understanding of him.
Right, let's unpack that legacy.
At his core, Jefferson subscribed to the political ideals of John Locke, Francis Bacon, and Isaac Newton, whom he considered the three greatest men who ever lived. alongside other Enlightenment thinkers like Montesquieu and Voltaire.
That Enlightenment foundation again.
It's crucial. Jefferson wasn't an isolated thinker. He was a brilliant synthesizer of Enlightenment thought, applying these philosophical frameworks to the unique challenge of forming a new Republican government. He described himself as an Epicurean, agreeing with Epictetus's works, further highlighting his intellectual depth and commitment to reason as a guiding principle in a rational life.
His political philosophy deeply advocated for the independent yeoman farmer, that is, the self-sufficient landowner and cultivator, and an agrarian life as ideals of Republican virtues. He believed this fostered independence, self-reliance, and civic participation, often distrusting cities and financiers.
Yes, that agrarian ideal was central. He favored decentralized government power, believing tyranny in Europe stemmed from corrupt political establishments and monarchies. Initially favoring restricted voting to propertied males, in retirement he advocated for general suffrage for all taxpayers and militiamen and equal representation.
So his views on suffrage evolved.
They did seem to broaden over time. He saw public education and a free press as absolutely essential for a healthy democracy, believing individual liberties were the fruit of political equality. This shift reflects an evolving commitment to a broader, more inclusive democracy, even if still limited by modern standards. His distrust of centralized power and financial interests became a defining characteristic of Jeffersonian democracy, influencing generations of American political thought.
And this brings us to perhaps the most profound and challenging aspect of his legacy. The complexities of slavery.
The unavoidable contradiction.
Scholars offer radically differing interpretations of his views, ranging from proto-abolitionists to deeply entrenching the institution. He lived in a planter economy, owning approximately 600 people over his lifetime, inheriting 175, with others born on his plantations. About 100 enslaved people lived at Monticello at any given time.
600 people, that's a staggering number.
It is. He purchased some to reunite families, but also sold about 110 for economic reasons. While he claimed, "My first wish is that the laborers may be well treated and allowed Sundays and Christmas off," some scholars cite cases of excessive whippings and his nail factory being staffed by enslaved children.
His actions regarding slavery reflect a deeply conflicted individual. He certainly felt slavery was harmful, but had significant reservations about immediate emancipation, advocating instead for gradual approaches. His 1779 proposal for voluntary training and resettlement and his 1782 legislation allowing slaveholders to free slaves show early efforts.
So there were attempts at reform.
Yes. He included a strong section criticizing King George III for supposedly forcing slavery onto the colonies in his declaration draft. His 1784 proposal to abolish slavery in all Western territories failed by just one vote. But the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 partially achieved this. He did free Robert Hemings, James Hemings, and Harriet Hemings during his lifetime, and his will freed 5 male Hemings slaves. These were certainly anti-slavery actions, in context.
But this aspect truly complicates our understanding. During his presidency, he allowed slavery's diffusion into the Louisiana Territory, hoping, in a deeply pragmatic and frankly disturbing calculation, to prevent slave uprisings in Virginia and South Carolina secession.
A calculation based on fear and political expediency.
His public silence on the issue during his presidency was largely due to the dangerous North-South rift it caused. He wrote privately in 1805, "I have long since given up the expectation of any early provision for the extinguishment of slavery among us." His fears of a race war, heightened by the Haitian Revolution, clearly deepened his reservations about emancipation.
And then there's that incredibly uncomfortable detail.
Yeah. He even calculated a 4% profit on the birth of black children in 1792, seeing slavery as an investment strategy. This is a stark illustration of the deep chasm between his articulated ideals and his actions within the economic realities of his time. It's just hard to reconcile.
It is. And this leads us directly back to the Jefferson-Hemings controversy. Claims that Jefferson fathered children with his enslaved woman, Sally Hemings, began in 1802 with James T. Callender's allegations. In 1998, a Y-DNA study of descendants revealed a match with the male Jefferson line.
The DNA evidence.
Right. The Thomas Jefferson Foundation then concluded a high probability that Jefferson fathered Eston Hemings and likely all of Sally Hemings' children. Archaeological excavations in Monticello have revealed what are believed to be Sally Hemings' quarters adjacent to Jefferson's bedroom. The consensus among most historians now is that Jefferson and Sally Hemings had a sexual relationship and he fathered her children, illustrating the complex human relationships that existed within the system of slavery.
So the historical consensus has shifted.
Significantly, while a minority still argues the evidence is inconclusive, citing other possibilities, the DNA evidence, combined with oral histories and archaeological findings, has undeniably shifted the historical understanding. It forces us to confront the full scope of his contradictions between his public ideals of liberty and his private actions as a slaveholder.
His religious views are equally complex and often surprising. Baptized Episcopal, he later spurned biblical Christianity, influenced by deist authors.
A deist leaning, common among Enlightenment figures.
He identified as a Christian in the only sense in which Jesus wished anyone to be, defining it as following Jesus' simple moral teachings. He famously compiled the Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, known as the Jefferson Bible, in which he literally cut out all miracles and the resurrection, aiming to make Jesus compatible with reason.
Trying to rationalize faith.
He was firmly anti-clerical, writing, "Every age the priest has been hostile to liberty. They have perverted the purest religion ever preached to man into mystery and jargon." He drafted the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, an achievement he proudly listed on his epitaph. And in 1802, he interpreted the First Amendment as building a wall of separation between church and state.
That famous phrase.
This is a fascinating glimpse into his private spiritual world, far removed from the public image.
His views on banks and economic policy were deeply intertwined with his agrarian vision for America. He profoundly distrusted government banks and opposed public borrowing, believing it created long-term debt, bred monopolies, and invited dangerous speculation. He argued that each generation should curtail all debt within 19 years.
A principle we definitely don't follow now.
Not exactly. He strenuously opposed Hamilton's National Bank, believing it ignored the needs of farmers and violated the 10th Amendment. As president, he was eventually persuaded by Gallatin to keep the bank, but he continually sought to restrain its influence. His fear of concentrated financial power and perpetual debt directly informed his political actions and his efforts to differentiate the Democratic-Republican Party from the Federalists.
Beyond his political and philosophical pursuits, Jefferson was a true polymath whose inventive spirit touched everything from everyday objects to groundbreaking science. He was a keen farmer, obsessed with new crops, soil, and scientific agricultural techniques, even trying to grow European wine grapes at Monticello, contributing to American viticulture.
A scientific farmer.
He mastered architecture through self-study, popularizing the Neo-Palladian style in the U.S. through designs like the Virginia State Capitol, the University of Virginia, and of course, Monticello. He conducted pioneering archaeological excavations of Native American burial mounds in Virginia in 1784, using stratigraphic methods and concluding that present-day Native Americans' ancestors could have built them. He was a naturalist and a pioneer in paleontology, publishing on the extinct sloth Megalonyx.
His inventiveness wasn't limited to grand designs or scientific theory. He invented many practical devices, including a revolving book stand and an improved pedometer. He is widely credited with creating the swivel chair, which he famously used to write much of the Declaration of Independence.
The swivel chair, an essential invention.
Right. He also had a lifelong interest in linguistics, speaking, reading, and writing in French, Greek, Italian, and German. He even taught himself Spanish during a 19-day journey to France using a grammar guide and Don Quixote. It's also interesting that, not being an outstanding orator, he preferred writing, starting the tradition of presidents sending written State of the Union addresses to Congress, a practice that continued until 1913.
Ultimately, Jefferson is hailed as an icon of individual liberty, democracy, and republicanism, the singular author of the Declaration of Independence, and a true Renaissance man. Polls consistently rank him among the top five U.S. presidents. He is memorialized on Mount Rushmore, the Jefferson Memorial, the $2 bill, and the nickel. However, his historical reputation is now, more than ever, viewed through the lens of his profound contradictions, particularly regarding slavery and his paternity of children with enslaved people.
The removal of a plaster model of his statue from the New York City Council Chamber in October 2021, due to these very issues, is a tangible symbol of this ongoing reassessment. It forces a reevaluation of how we remember and honor figures from our past, and how we grapple with the complex legacy of those who shaped our nation.
Outro.
Wow. We've journeyed through the extraordinary life of Thomas Jefferson, from the fields of Shadwell to the halls of power, from the philosophical salons of Europe to the drafting of documents that literally shaped the world. We've seen his boundless curiosity, his intellectual prowess, and his unwavering commitment to Republican ideals.
But we've also squarely faced his deeply unsettling contradictions. A champion of liberty who owned hundreds of enslaved people, a proponent of natural rights whose actions often failed to align with those ideals, and whose personal life remains a complex tapestry of relationships and power dynamics, particularly concerning Sally Hemings. It's a legacy of both light and shadow, and one that we, as a nation, are still very much grappling with.
So as you reflect on Thomas Jefferson, maybe consider this. What does it mean for a nation founded on such profound ideals to grapple with the uncomfortable truths of its founders? How do we balance immense contributions with glaring moral failures? And what can Jefferson's complex legacy teach you about the ongoing, often messy, pursuit of a more perfect union?
Perhaps it's a reminder that great individuals, and indeed great nations, are rarely monolithic, but rather a collection of evolving ideas, profound achievements, and, yes, deep-seated imperfections. It's complicated.
That's a perfect note to end on. Share your thoughts with someone, dive deeper into one of the topics we touched on today, or simply take a moment to ponder the enduring questions raised by one of America's most pivotal and paradoxical figures. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.